For those of you who don't know me, I'm Paul. I'm a postgrad here. I'm in my third year now in systems biology, and I'm a member of St. Ed's just down the road. So I just introduced Dr. Alexander to you. So Dr. Alexander read biochemistry here at Oxford, where he was also president of the Oxford Intercollegiate Christian Union, OIQ, before going on to do a PhD in neurochemistry at the Institute of Psychiatry in London. Following this, he spent 15 years in academic positions in the Middle East, first of all in Turkey, and then in the American University of Beirut, Lebanon, where he helped to establish the National Institute of the Human Genetics. More recently, Dr. Alexander was chairman of the Molecular Immunology Program and head of the Laboratory of Lymphocyte Signaling and Development in the Abraham Institute, Cambridge. He was also the director of the Faraday Institute for Science and Religion at St. Edmund's College, Cambridge, where he is a fellow. Dr. Alexander writes lectures and broadcasts widely in the field of science and religion. Since 1992, he's been editor of the journal Science and Christian Belief, and currently serves as the on the National Committee of Christians in Science, and as a member of the International Society for Science and Religion. He's written a number of books, including relating science and Christianity, including Rebuilding the Matrix, Science and Faith in the 21st Century, Beyond Belief, Science, Faith and Ethical Challenges, Creation Revolution, Do We Have to Choose? And most recently, Biology and Ideology. Biology and Ideology, from Descartes to Dawkins. As a piece of interesting trivia, you may be interested to know that he is the nephew of the great British historian A.J.P. Taylor. Tonight, he'll be speaking on the topic Genes, Determinism and God. Please join me in welcoming him.
Well, thanks very much. Laugh than that little bit of trivia gets put up, actually. Yeah, it's good to be here again, and it's a number of times I've spoken in this upper room to various gatherings. Always good to be here. I need to catch the 9:32 back to Cambridge if I'm going to get there tonight, and that depends on whether the signaling has been repaired between Oxford and Paddington. So we're going to keep focused tonight, and you know, keep things moving along. Let me first start by saying that I would like to make my acknowledgement at the beginning here, and especially to thank Neil Whiteway, who's one of our Faraday Institute staff members in Cambridge, who's been very helpful in and continues to be in quite a bit of the research on this whole area, which I'm going to be talking about this evening, which actually was the topic for my GIFID lectures, which I gave about a month ago, was it? No, early December up at St. Andrews University, which is four lectures. So you're going to get a sort of abstract, really, of four GIFIDs tonight. So I'm going to try and get through quite a bit of material, and I hope that's going to work for us. One of the very striking characteristics of cultural life over the past 10 years, at least, has been the dominance of genomics and DNA, the way it's come into popular culture and so on. And really the reasons, I guess, are not hard to discern. And that is, of course, arising from the sequence of the human genome, its publication back in 1994. And of course, I'm going to mention as we go along a number of definitions. I know the biologists here don't need it, but just to mention that when we're referring to the genome in biological talk, we're referring to that sum total of all the information that's contained in the DNA in the cell of a particular organism. And I think it's partly that sequencing triumph, in a way, which has tended to bring that whole topic of genes and even genetic determinism and genes and behavior and all kinds of things much more publicly out into popular culture and the media and so forth and so on. Just a few months ago, there was another great wave of papers, actually 30 papers were published almost at the same time, summarizing the first findings from this ENCODE project. ENCODE stands for the Encyclopedia of DNA Elements, and it aims to map all the functional sequences of the human genome. It's an ongoing project. This was the first wave of papers that came out. Notice the main paper in this series starts by emphasizing that, and I quote, the human genome encodes the blueprint of life. And so the genome now is often referred to as a kind of instruction manual, giving the impression that the human body is sort of assembled from a kit, you know, and if you have the right manual, you'll get the body you do have, you know, a bit like this IKEA things that some of us can never put together, but a similar kind of idea. It's a blueprint for life. the language of DNA, I don't know if you noticed this in the past few years, the language of it's in her or his DNA has come very much into our daily speech. And here's Brad Pitt saying that carrying a gun in America is in American DNA. I won't make any comment on that. And here's the cloud computing service provider Oxygen assuring us that our security is in their DNA. London has apparently had 2,000 years of urban DNA, whatever that means, I haven't a clue. But you can see how this language of DNA is coming into daily speech. And I think the situation is not helped by the insistence of the media to keep reporting on the discovery of a gene for this, that, or the other. There are mean genes, there are gluttony genes, there are gangster genes, there are liberal genes, there are conservative genes. There's even the whimsical suggestion of a geneticism gene that predisposes some people to think that behaviour is caused by genes. pages of the Guardian a few years ago, I can't like that one. Of course, as we all know, I think a gene is simply a stretch of DNA which encodes certain kinds of information. There is no single gene that encodes for any kind of behaviour in any living organism at all. Now, scientists, I think, for the most part, to be fair, have been careful to avoid the language of a gene for something or other, knowing that they don't exist. But the transformation of a story from a serious scientific paper into its media presentation actually can be quite dramatic. Here's an example. It's a paper published in PNS a few years ago, 2009, and it reports the findings by a collaborative research group, of whom the PI, I think, was at Brown University. And the authors here are reporting a correlation between a form of an enzyme known as monoamine oxidase that generates rather low enzyme activity and higher levels of aggression in certain people who have been provoked in a certain kind of way. Now, rather unwisely, I think, the authors refer in their abstract to the name of this particular gene, the warrior gene, the sort of nickname. But on the whole, the paper's a pretty sort of serious kind of reporting of a bit of science. But now look at the press release that came out of Brown University at the same time with the publication of this paper. Warrior gene predicts aggressive behavior after provocation. Subjects penalized opponents by administering various amounts of hot sauce. Actually, that was part of the experimental protocol they had. It was interesting. So that's how they got their aggression, I think, which maybe not surprising. Anyway, but we remember this story is coming out of a serious academic institution. So you can't really then blame the media as they pick it up. Here's an example from ABC News. You can't blame them for their kind of headlines. 1 in 3 men have violence gene. Scientists say, notice that, scientists say it's the warrior gene. At least in this particular presentation, they pitched the article in a way that said that free will trumps all. But I think the point I'm trying to make here is that in today's news-hungry world, inevitably, sometimes these scientific discoveries are going to be packaged and repackaged in ways that will appeal to a certain readership or blogosphere or whatever it is, because oral journalists have to sell papers and they have to get their blogs read and so on. So, but I think sometimes the scientists don't help by the way in which they present their particular results. By the way, in this particular case, it is true that 1 out of 3 men are carriers of this particular polymorphism, this particular variant of the gene for monoamine oxidase. So it's really hardly predictive of anything at all, despite that particular title. Now, of course, these days, everybody knows that we are all the product, as every biological organism is the product of genes and environment. There are no genetic determinists, serious geneticist certainly believes that, you know, we're all somehow determined by our genes and so on. Despite this rather famous quote from Jim Watson that we used to think that our fate was in our stars, now we know in large part that our fate is in our genes. And neither are there any strict environmental determinists either. I mean, everybody knows that we're the product of a complex gene-environment interaction, and I think it's precisely because of that, actually, there is a problem. It's precisely in the use of such dichotomous language, I'm going to call it, of genes, environment, and so on, that we actually find a rather fragmented image of human personhood in which the reifying forces of genes and environment are somehow in a struggle for hegemony over the production of human personhood. And so you end up with a picture of a human as a sort of battlefield of competing influences going on, pulling in different directions. And that dichotomous language, as you probably know, is inherited from a very famous person, Francis Galton, who was the first cousin of Charles Darwin back in the late 19th century. And it was he who first introduced the language of nature and nurture in his book of Men and Science, Their Nature and Nurture, published 1874. As Galton himself pointed out, the phrase nature and nurture is a convenient jingle of words, useful because it separates under two distinct heads the innumerable elements of which personality is composed. Adding, and I quote from Galton, that no carefulness of nurture can overcome the evil tendencies of an intrinsically bad physique, weak brain, or brutal disposition. You have to remember he was a late Victorian, okay, in his language. But in his book on twins, Galton concluded that nature is far stronger than nurture within the limited range that I have been careful to assign the latter. So it's really Galton who set the parameters for the discussion right up to the present day. So if you go onto Amazon or you go down the road to a bookshop and you look in the genetics section or the pop genetics section or something, you'll find dozens of books with these kind of titles, Nature or Nurture. These are all real books out there in the bookshops. Nature or Nurture. Nature and Nurture. The Nurture of Nature. Nurture by Nature. Nurture through Nature. The Nurture-Nature Debates Bridging the Gap. Nurture or Nature, the Great Brain Debate. And even a rather worrying title, I thought, Nature versus Nature, Why We Kill. So I kind of feel almost rather sorry for authors and publishers trying to find new combinations, you know, the words nature and nurture, because I actually think we've reached a kind of saturation point in that particular market. Now, I've read quite a few of these books, I haven't read all these books, but I would say many of them are actually good books. I mean, a number of them are using that title as a launchpad to critique this kind of dichotomous language between nature and nurture. But at the same time, almost by having the title, they're reinforcing this particular framework for thinking about the development of biological organisms. And I think it illustrates the power of language to probably shape scientific discourse in a way, certainly in the popular domain, that is not always most helpful. And I think it's very actually difficult for us to get away from those sort of dichotomous types of contrast, hot and cold, light and darkness, extrovert, introvert, labor, conservative, whatever it is, nature, nurture, genes, environment. Go on Wikipedia, what do we find? Nature versus nurture, even though you've got the struggle, you know, the fight going on between these two kind of forces which are pulling us apart, they're competing. So what I want to do this evening is to move the goalposts and to reframe the discussion within a different kind of a framework, which will be familiar, I think, to any biologist here, perhaps less familiar to those who don't have much biological background. But I think it's going to be a framework that will do much more justice to the complexity of biological organisms. And I think in the process we're going to see just how important that sort of reshaping, the rebuilding the matrix, if you like, is to certain theological questions, particularly as they relate to issues of human identity, human freedom, human personhood, and so on. And I hope you'll see that as we go along. Okay, so in place of that dichotomous language, what I want to suggest is no longer fit for purpose, I want to go for this framework, which I think is more faithful to the science, for a start. And I've got here an acronym, which happens to be a Latin word as well. That was purely accidental, by the way. It's DICI, if you're... or Dicky, depending if you're a classicist or a theologian, which means to be said. But it stands for Developmental Integrated Complementary Interactionism. Okay, a bit of a mouthful. Certainly not as jingly as nature and nurture. I'm just going to use it as, if you like, a series of four pegs on which to hang certain biological ideas as we go along. So I'm going to talk about it as DICI, not as his Latin pronunciation. And I'm now going to apologize for all those biologists here for whom the next few minutes are pretty familiar stuff, but I think is important to tackle this topic properly. So let's start then with a newly fertilized human egg, a zygote. and is what is inherited from the parents, of course, is not. Naked DNA, as some people think, by itself, naked DNA can do nothing, but it's a complex system that we inherit, a system of DNA and RNA and proteins and nutrients that together operate to regulate cell growth and division. In fact, if you look inside a human egg just prior to fertilization, you'll find it contains at least 3,000 proteins, it contains at least 7,500 different messenger RNAs, it contains thousands of small non-coding RNA molecules and so on. It's a complete complex package. That's what we are inheriting. And by itself, DNA would be about as useless as a CD with a computer program on without a computer to run it on. I mean, DNA is pretty useless by itself. Okay. And so right from the beginning, there are two types of environment. If you like, we've got the immediate environment of the DNA within the cell. We've got the macroenvironments. They include the fallopian tubule, of course, down which that early zygote is about to travel. And then, of course, we've got the mother. We've got the mother's own broader environment, indeed her social environment as well. And so the DNA and these two types of environment are completely integrated from the moment of fertilization. And so a key part of the microenvironment then of a gene is other genes. The genome operates as an integrated system. And one of the key findings of the ENCODE project that I just mentioned, that at least 20%, I mean, claims maybe go a bit higher than that, I'm going to settle with 20%, at least 20% of the genome involving around 500,000 distinct DNA sequences is involved in regulating how genes are expressed. That means how they're switched on and switched off. Now, as you probably know, there are only around 21,000 protein encoding genes in the human genome. There are around 16,000 RNA genes. But those in turn are regulated by these hundreds of transcription factors, and those are the factors which switch the genes on and off. And so you've got a vast and complex network of interactions, and that's just one figure, you know, to illustrate the point filched out of one of the ENCODE papers. And so in the early zygote, it's not actually the DNA which causes development to begin, but rather it's proteins inherited from the mother, in the mother's egg, which causes, which triggers, if you like, the whole initiation of the growth process, those protein transcription factors inside the zygote. And so those proteins actually are the main players in the orchestra of life as they trigger off that initial process of cell development. They are, if you like, the initial causal agents that cause the genes to play this integrated symphony of life, which is then going to produce that wonderful biological organism. So following implantation, the fetus is now exposed, of course, to a whole new range of microenvironments. It's got now the placental blood circulation, it's got oxygen and hormones and glucose and nutrients and lipids and maybe alcohol and, who knows, cigarette smoke, whatever else is coming along. And the fetus itself can taste, it can smell, it can hear certain stimuli, especially in the third trimester, in a way that distinguishes it from other babies once it's born. There's a whole huge literature about those key fetal influences. That explains, by the way, why a newborn will choose its mother's voice over other females once it's been born. It's heard its mother's voice, especially in the last trimester. And if the mother was depressed during pregnancy, that won't happen. She hasn't been talking. And so the fetus hasn't been hearing the mother's voice. And then at birth, the newborn's now bombarded with this fascinating new array of sights and sounds and smells and touch and language and people and dogs and cats and everything. And incredible entry into the world, which we have all experienced. Unfortunately, don't remember, I think. Anyway, very scary sort of time of our life. But it's good to remember that the infant brain is not some sort of miniature version of the adult brain, but it's a self-organizing system that only self-organizes properly if that growing child encounters the right environmental stimuli at just the right the right moment. So the adult brain, our brains contain now around 10 to 11 neurons, something like that. In fact, twice as many as that number are made in the course of fetal brain development About half of them were pruned away in a very critical process during development. And so the fetal brain cells are actually neuroblasts, they're immature neurons, they then mature into neurons later on. But so at birth, they're still, the vast majority is still immature cells. They don't have many synaptic connections, the axons are not even myelinated, and it's then the experience of that growing baby, especially the first year or so of life, which then, as it were, generates its brain by this wonderful, amazing process of self-generation. And you can tell what's going on just simply visually by looking at the synaptic density over here on the left at birth compared to 24 months. You get this incredible increase in brain weight. It goes from around 300 grams up to around 900 grams during the first year of life. That's not due to neuronal replication, that is due to this vast array of myelination and synaptic density and arborization, it's called, going on during the early process of brain development. And so there are certain critical periods during that period, as I mentioned, where you really need the right input at the right time. So if the baby is blind from birth, for example, through undetected glaucoma or something like that, then the whole visual system in the brain doesn't develop properly, and you can have permanent visual impairment because of that. So children born with congenital cataracts in both eyes have large permanent deficits in motion processing, whereas children who develop cataracts from 6 to 12 months have no such deficit, and lots of other examples there as well. So the brain is displaying considerable plasticity then during development, and it's the wider environment interacting with the growing child that helps to kind of construct, if you like, that emerging brain, this emergent phenomenon. So if we now continue along our development trajectory, we go into adulthood, the integrated interactionism between the genes, the microenvironments, the macroenvironments become even more striking, actually, in some ways, because now the growing individual, there he is making lifestyle choices about what kind of environment he's going to live in or she's going to live in, about whether to smoke or not, how much alcohol to drink, about whether to live in a clean environment, whether to live in a polluted environment, whether to take drugs, whether to live socially, have a lot of friends, whether to be a rather lonely sort of individual hunched up over a computer. All of that is feeding back and impacting epigenetically on what we now call the epigenome. All those epigenetic modifications of the DNA that regulate how all of those genes are expressed. Now, epigenetics, if you're not familiar with that, refers to the chemical modifications of the DNA that regulate all that switching on and off. Some are chemical modifications of the histone proteins wrapped around the DNA, and some are direct chemical modifications of the DNA itself. So if you like, if genetics provides the hardware of inheritance, then epigenetics provides the software, rather sort of loose kind of metaphor, but I think it does some work for us. And epigenetic regulation then provides a key pathway leading from the macro through the microenvironments and then impacting on the DNA itself in ways that impact the rest of our lives, in ways that are with us for the rest of our life. And that's the key point. So here we are then, DICEY, in a nutshell, a very brief overview here, but just to give you a flavor to see how the development of organism is the actual key. It's an ongoing process that continues until death. So in biological terms, development is zygote to death. That's the span. All of the components of that process are very tightly integrated. There's a continued interaction between the various components of the genomic system, the microenvironments, and so on. And there are many complementary processes here happening in parallel, and so they're completely kind of subvert any idea of linear causal relationships going on. And so this idea, which I don't think people hear of, but you get out the meter, sort of, here's the genome, there's the kit, and then it sort of transmits its information in a kind of linear way. You don't get that at all from the biology. That's really impossible. And so in a way, the DICEY concept simply bypasses this language of dichotomous nature and nurture. There are no two separate, reified entities that somehow interact with each other. They don't exist. Okay, that's the main point. So, in a sense, the insight of the DICEY approach is that 100% of the 100% of the human organism, 100% of us is, is actually influenced by, is due to our genomes, and 100% is due to the environment. I mean, it's an integrated system, that's the key thing. Now, some people find, if they're not biologists especially, kind of think about this developmental process as being a bit complicated or not easy to get your head around. So I hope you'll forgive me if I pick on something a little bit easier, okay, in terms of development. This is a black forest cake, okay. So most of that cake then is made of flour. Actually, it's more than 50%. This is a real recipe, by the way. I looked it up. It's on the web. So if you don't have any, if you don't have any flour, then definitely don't have any cake. Less than 1% is baking powder, but if you have no baking powder, you have no cake. Okay, so around 8% is chocolate powder, so no powder, then definitely no chocolate cake anyway. And so no correct oven heat, and you know, precisely the right temperature, then you don't get any cake at all. So the cake is the product of a highly complex developmental process in which the properties of the recipe are indeed critical to the external outcome, but it would be odd and indeed impossible to try and assign proportionality to the original components in the finished product. By that stage, for example, the baking powder has disappeared, it's been chemically transformed, it doesn't exist anymore, and that's true of some of the other components as a whole. So the cake, if you like, has emergent properties. Has emergent properties which are non-reducible to its initial components. It's a product of a complex developmental process. Simple illustration that maybe can help some people who are not biologists especially. And that brings us to the important C word in Dicey, the complementarity. There are dozens and dozens of different complementary stories, if you like, going on, which we can describe, but they're all going on at the same time, and they're all relevant, and they're all focused on by different people in different labs. No doubt many of them around Oxford at the present moment. So these are, you know, choices in epigenetics, synapses and memory, we can go on and on, all the different kind of discourses which you can, the different narratives if you like, which you can look at and write about and publish papers about going on during this process. They're all important, they're all ongoing stories, as it were, weaving the individuality of that unique human person. And there are many narratives to be told. The notion of causality, I think, also becomes quite problematic when we're considering complex systems. So the philosopher, the late J.L. Mackey, spoke of causes, and I quote, as insufficient but necessary parts of unnecessary but sufficient conditions. Now, to unpackage that tongue-twisting definition a little, we can ask the question as to whether human personalities would be as different as they are without the variant genomes that different individuals possess. I would want to say, certainly not. These variant genomes play a critical role. They are a necessary part of that story. But equally, I think it would be mistaken to assert that a particular variant genome causes a particular personality. So in reality, there are many tributaries in the river of life flowing together to cause the emergence of this unique human individual. And the variant genome is just one tributary amongst many, which is, as it were, merging together with others to form this this river of human life. So human life starts then with the inheritance of a complex system, not DNA. We don't inherit DNA from our parents. We inherit a complex system, and it is with the dynamic characteristics of that ongoing complex system that human identity is to be found. Now, given the power of developmental biology, which is just what really we've been talking about then, to paint a picture of human identity that renders that language, that dichotomous language of nature and nurture, as being outdated, why is it that that dichotomous language is so powerful? Why does it have such a powerful grip upon the human imagination? As I say, I think one of the reasons simply it's the way the story is told in books and by the media and so on and so forth, and that is undoubtedly very powerful indeed. But there's more to it, I think, than that. And so there's a very powerful contributor to the maintenance of dichotomous thinking in this area, and that comes from the world of behavioral genetics and its very distinctive definition and understanding of the word heritability. And I want to spend a few minutes on that because I think it's really important. So each human individual, picked from anywhere in the world, we all differ from each other between somewhere around 0.5 and 1% of our genome, actually, much more than we used to think even a few years ago. And that's based on contemporary genomic sequencing. Okay. So new mutations, we were just talking about this at dinner, new mutations are being added to the gene pool at a faster rate, certainly than most people, I think, imagine. But in a very recent paper, it seems that each new baby, on average, contains 60 new mutations in their DNA. Many of them will be silent, they won't make any difference. On the other hand, some of them will. So that's quite a big load of new mutations being added to the human population, when you think of the number of births going on around the place. So the challenge of behavioral genetics then is to try and find out whether human genetic variation between individuals has anything at all to do with differential behaviors. And we can only attempt that by studying variation within a particular population using twin and adoption studies. That's how it's done. And I'm only going to mention this this rather controversial field rather briefly, because it's a huge field and I can't possibly do it justice in a few minutes. So apologies to anyone here who's in that field for treating your field rather briefly in this way. But let's just have a look at it for a moment. Now, quantitative behavioral genetics is seeking to separate out the influence of genes and environment on variation in a particular trait. So the meaning of trait in this particular context refers to anything that you can measure that varies between individuals. It might be IQ, it could be personality, it could be sexual orientation, it could be religiosity, political commitments. A lot of work on that recently, by the way. Hours per week spent watching television, all kinds of things there. Most traits vary with a normal distribution. There are some exceptions. And so what a heritability study does is to calculate the proportion of the total individual variance that's associated with either genes or the environment. That's what it's trying to do. Now, the heritability here is defined in a way that's quite different from its use in daily speech, and that's the key thing to pick up here. So the heritability is defined as the proportion of the variance in a trait in a specified population that can be ascribed to genetic variation. So a typical heritability study proportions the variance according to three components: the genetic influence H, the shared or common environmental influences C, and the non-shared or unique environmental influences E. Common environmental influences, they're going to be factors such as perhaps socioeconomic status, they're going to be diet, they're going to be parenting style, that sort of thing that may be the same for all the people under a single roof. All those items which contribute to the similarity of the trait under consideration. Non-shared environmental influences are those which are going to make a person different from others with respect to a certain trait. For example, one child is bullied at school, another is not. And so forth. One child takes drugs, the other doesn't, and so forth and so on. Now, each of these components is a proportion of the total variance. Okay, they've all got to add up to one. Okay, and they're squared for statistical reasons. And so the genetic influence plus the shared environmental influence plus the non-shared environmental influence is said to equal the total influence on that particular trait. And so that heritability, remember, is H, that's 8 squared, and notice that 8 squared is dimensionless. It doesn't have any units, so it only makes sense when it's compared alongside other components. And so we can write heritability as a percentage also, which leads to a huge amount of confusion, because that percentage is often then reported by the media and is interpreted as if that means you're actually inheriting 40% of this particular trait from your parents, which is not what this means at all, as you can see. Heritability does not mean inheritance. It's the percentage of the total variance in a given population which you can ascribe to genetic variance. Okay. So then, in the classic approach, the variation of a given trait in a population of monozygotic and dizygotic twins is measured. Raised in the same family, these are twins raised in the same family, independently, but They've had the same common environment, supposedly. So the investigator looks at how closely the scores between the twin pairs correlate with each other. And so correlation then measures how similar the deviation to one variable after deviations in another variable. You do the maths and you find, for example, that if the correlation regarding IQ measurements for identical twins is 0.86 and for non-identical twins is 0.6, then the heritability is twice the difference, or 0.52, or you can express that, as I say, as a percentage is 52%. So we say then, or the behavioral geneticists will say, that the heritability of IQ is 52%. It is actually, in many, many studies, that's what it comes out as. Okay. So in practice, for contemporary behavioral genetic studies, it's a lot more complicated than that. People use biometrical modeling techniques. They try and take into account some of the complications. They try and take into account genotype environmental correlations when there are possible effects of an individual's genetics on the environment. They also try and take into account what's called genotype times environmental interactions, which refers to the differential sensitivities of genotypes to environments and so on. So there's all kinds of different packages there for doing your modeling. Now, the field of quantitative genetics has a long history, has a long controversial history, it continues to the present day. Every year there are books published attacking it or defending it, and so forth. I think, actually, it is fair to say, I try and take a bit of a middle road on this whole thing, I think it's fair to say that even some of the key practitioners in this field do actually disagree about some fairly fundamental things in their field. But my aim here is not at all to be dismissive of the field. I think it's a serious research field, and we just have to look at the different results one by one, as it were, and think about them. But I do think it's worth pointing out that there are a number of complications here which have been often pointed out, but it's just worth mentioning a few. For example, we know that identical twins are not always identical due to the accumulation of mutations in the independent twins after embryo splitting. And I guess there are more than 400 papers now on identical twins which are discordant for certain genetic diseases, including chromosomal diseases like Down syndrome, and other traits and so on, psychiatric traits as well. So there's a huge amount of discordance, actually, even in the medical literature, between identical twins. And so forth. There are lots and lots of other complications. It turns out that identical twins are epigenetically more different from each other than non-identical twins at birth. There's quite a few papers on that, perhaps counterintuitively, and so on. Okay, so lots and lots of complications, lots and lots of confusing points, actually, or points which need to be thought about. I want to actually just make really two important points, which I think are more relevant, particularly for the discussion this evening. The first is just to point out again that heritability has acquired, if you like, during the latter half of the 20th century, this new and technical meaning. So it can actually now mean inheritance in some people's writings, and it can also mean heritability in the sense in which quantitative geneticists define it. And the problem is, I've read quite a lot of these books recently, and often you find that the meaning elides from one to the other, even during the course of the same article. And that can make it very confusing, I think, for your average reader, certainly, and that's a problem. Just to kind of give an illustration here about the confusing aspect of the word heritability, and this is not my illustration, this is Patrick Bateson's from Cambridge. He says, well, first we notice that nearly all people have two legs. When they only have one leg, it's due nearly always to an accident. In other words, it's due to the environment. And so the variation in legginess in the population is 100% environmental and 0% heritable. Okay, now when you say it that way, it sounds a little bit odd because we all know that you need genes in order to have legs. So it's just that in practice, the genomic system, if you like, always encounters, thankfully, the same system of microenvironments and macroenvironments during development. So people end up having two legs. The leg-building process is pretty much common to most nearly everybody that we see around us. So likewise, the heritability of having a brain is zero. There is no, as far as I know, tell me if I'm wrong, but as far as I know, in human population, everyone has a brain. Okay, so they wouldn't be his. So in other words, there is no variation in that trait of having a brain. So the heritability is zero. In other words, these illustrations are given to make people think about what's really going on here, about these sort of definitional kind of words. So we know, actually, that heritability as such really tells us nothing about the complex interplay of components that we were thinking about a moment ago in that dicey framework that, as a matter of fact, does lead to the development of traits. Okay, so the second point to note about heritability, that its very method of calculation actually, I think, perpetuates this sort of dichotomous language of nature and nurture and genes and environment and so on. Because once you give mathematical values to things with letters and you define them and then you give them a number, okay, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with the numbers are fine, you know, but it's just once you give them a number, then that certainly gives the impression there is a something there, you know, that it's referring to a sort of physical something. Or at least it can be easily be thought that's the way. When, in fact, of course, correlations between variance in a population can't really play that kind of role at all. Okay, you can't. Proportions of variations are mathematical constructs, okay, to do with your data. They're not actually a thing. Okay. But it's the thinginess of seeing an equation, I think, which encourages sometimes this rather dichotomous way of thinking that I want to critique. So how are we going to address then the question of genetic determinism? I haven't even talked about determinism yet, although it's in the title of the talk this evening. Determinism refers to individuals, it refers to their choices, it doesn't refer to variation in a population. So we can define determinism in this particular context in two different kinds of ways. The hard genetic determinism, which says that it's a thesis that given our particular genomes, our lives are not really up to us, and we're constrained to follow one particular feature. It's a hard form. There's a softer form of genetic determinism. The thesis that given our particular genomes, our lives are more likely to follow one particular feature. You may not want to call that determinism at all. We won't argue about the language just for the moment. But those are two different kinds of ways of looking at this issue. Now, hard genetic determinism belongs to medical genetics, I think, where a particular pathology does indeed often entail constraint in such a way the outcome is just going to happen. I'm afraid you're going to die before the age of 10. You have a lysosomal storage disease, that's what's going to happen. So hard genetic determinism, I think, is justified when it comes to those kind of severe medical genetic syndromes. But as far as the softer form of genetic determinism is concerned, it's really molecular behavioral molecular genetics, which is really the field I think we need to look to in order to think about that, and to think about the correlation between variant genes and certain kinds of human behavior. And what I want to do actually to illustrate that is just to look at one illustration, because I think it'll make sort of point. In 2010, there was a paper published in Nature. It described a Finnish population in which a particular gene variant was found to correlate with chance, greater than chance, in a population of prisoners who were characterized by severely increased impulsivity. And even the generally restrained journal Nature gave the news item reporting, this is in the news and views section of Nature, the writer there gave this report, terrible title, A Gene for Impulsivity. I have to say it's a phrase carefully avoided by the authors of the particular study. Some hack in the Nature office came up with that gene to kind of make people read it a bit better. Anyway, so, and of course it goes without saying, there is no gene for impulsivity. Let's just make that perfectly clear. But unfortunately, as we were thinking earlier, once you get those unfortunate phrases coming out, even in the scientific literature, you can't really blame the newspapers and the blogosphere for coming out with these particular wonderful set of reports. Here you go, the violent gene, genetic mutation found only in Finnish men that make them fight. Impulsive, it may be a genetic mutation. Scientists discover genes that trigger violent anger. Drunken rage could be in your genes, and so on. Note the deterministic language here. You know, here's a gene that's doing stuff to you. It's actually making you and posset is probably going to make you a criminal. You know, I mean, that's like, that's the kind of message you've got here. So we've got single genes, powerful, acting as powerful causative agents that are going to make you do stuff. Now, of course, as you might guess, the reality is a lot more mundane. What the investigators discovered was a novel mutation. We can just call it Q20 here for the sake of argument. It's a mutation introduced into the stop codon in one of the 15 human serotonin receptors, serotonin's a neurotransmitter that you've got in our brains. And what happens is when you have that mutation, it results in a very low level of that particular serotonin receptor in the human brain. And this novel mutation was discovered in 17 out of 228 cognitively normal, albeit violent, Finnish individuals who displayed high impulsivity compared to its presence in 7 out of 295 normal controls. In other words, there was a kind of threefold increase, if you like, higher tendency for this mutant gene to be found in those scoring high on the impulsivity kind of scale. So what do we kind of make of that kind of correlation then between a mutated gene and a violent subpopulation of offenders? Well, we note that out of the total 5.3 million population of Finland, the same authors of this paper actually estimated that around 106,000 individuals were carriers of, or are carriers, in fact, of this Q20 mutation. That's about 2% of the population. This is the bit they didn't add, but I looked up. So the number of Finns in prison is currently around 3,500. They're very quiet, well-behaved population. Any Finns? I mean, I went to Finland a few months ago, and it's just such a civil society. I'm wondering, I'm surprised about anyone in jail at all. Anyway, so 3,500. So clearly, I mean, the vast majority of people with a Q20 mutation are not violent offenders. That's the first point. And secondly, it should be noted that each individual worldwide varies in around 1 out of 1,000 of the DNA nucleotides, the genetic letters that make up our DNA. So we have around 3 million or 3 million of these variants, so-called single nucleotide polymorphisms in our bodies and so on. And so it's quite possible that the 17 violent offenders in the study also share hundreds of other SNPs, as they're called, single nucleotide polymorphisms, besides that Q20 mutation, which also identify them as a particular cohort. In fact, the statisticians here will be able to tell us what that has to be the case, you know, that probably has to be the case. And so it's quite possible that none of those SNPs, including Q20 as it happens, are necessarily anything to do with impulsivity, because we know that correlation does not necessarily entail causation. So, I think the conclusion of this study, as far as I can see, is it is of interest that this Q20 mutation in the serotonin receptor gene correlates with a small subpopulation displaying this high impulsivity, which entails, which also correlates with criminality. But the vast majority, as we've noticed, of people in Finland carrying this mutation are law-abiding citizens who will never end up in jail and so on. So, having said that, of course, it's entirely possible that there are cohorts of gene variants, probably dozens, probably hundreds actually, which correlate with individuals with a tendency to be impulsive and which thereby contribute to the rich diversity of the human population. So that study in no way excludes that, which I think is a very likely possibility, but we have to be careful about interpreting one particular study. But what happened if there was a gene that correlated with nearly all the criminality in the world? Well, as it happens, there is. Okay. So it's known as SRI, and it's found on the Y chromosome. Okay. So if you look at all the average percentage of males in all 131 countries' prisons, it's 96% of the population is male. Okay. It's a very, very tight correlation between the SRI gene, which is what we males need to make us male, and criminality. And I suspect that probably we're not going to find any other correlation between any gene and criminality that's ever going to be as high as 96%. It's a pretty high kind of correlation, which identifies that particular population. It makes the point, you know, that obviously when we find that someone who's arrested happens to have a Y chromosome, well, we just note it down as a male, first of all, without thinking about the strategy. But, we still hold those people, for the large part, unless they have some serious psychiatric genetic mutation as well, as going to jail. You know, the people are responsible for their actions. So if we take now, the field of behavioural molecular genetics overall, we have a picture which is emerging of hundreds, probably thousands, of variant genes which, taken together, contribute to this rich diversity of the human population. And I think the data are entirely consistent with the process of a developmental integrated complementary interactionism. In other words, variant genomes, which are unique to every person on Earth, who has ever lived, or whoever ever will live. I mean, there's enough variation, potentially, in the human genome to cater for individuality in any person who's ever born for the foreseeable future, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of years in the future as well. And I would suggest those variant genomes are involved in generating that human unique individuality, not as a causal agent, but as part of that complex system which brings about broad swathe of different personalities which characterizes all of the spheres from this evening. As it were, it provides the broad contours of our lives within which we then operate and carry out our beings, carry on our lives. So then, lastly, I want to think a bit about how this biologically conceptualized notion of human personhood comes into conversation with Christian faith. We've just been thinking about biology so far, but how does that biological story get into conversation, if you like, with the theological story? And I want to suggest it does so in many ways, but for the sake of the discussion this evening, through the Imago Dei, through the whole idea of the humankind being made in the image of God, which is such a powerful idea, which has helped to shape education, healthcare, politics, and so many other things in the Western world in ways perhaps we're only dimly aware. But I'd like us to start this evening by thinking about how Genesis understands the image of God, dwell on that a little bit, and then to see how we apply that in this conversation. Of course, there are only three mentions of the language of the image of God in the early chapters of Genesis, as I think we know here. Let's remind ourselves of the one in Genesis 1. God said, "Let us make Adam, humankind, in our image, in our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, and over all the creatures that move along the ground." And so God created Adam in his own image, in the image of God he created him, male and female he created them. So the question is then, how would the first readers, if you like, of this Genesis text have understood this language of being made in God's image? And I'm sure, as you know, an important clue comes from the many contemporary Mesopotamian texts and Egyptian texts that talk about the king as being in the divine image of course, in those days, of one of the panoply of polytheistic gods that were revered by all the nations around at that time. Here, for example, is a 7th century Assyrian king, Esarhaddon, being addressed by one of his correspondents, the astrologer and court official Adad-shum-usur, as the image of the god Marduk, or Bel, synonyms. Quote, "A free man is as the shadow of a god, a shadow of a god. The slave is as the shadow of a free man, but the king, he is like unto the very image of God." And you can find quite a range of those citations in the Mesopotamian literature, and even far more frequently so in the Egyptian literature over a very poor period of time. And so, most likely, the early readers of Genesis would have first thought of kingship, it is suggested, as they encountered this idea of humankind made in the image of God. Humankind created with dignity and worth, clearly short of divinization, but nevertheless called to play this sort of kingly role, male and female alike, in caring for the created order. So the kingly and priestly roles previously allocated the privileged few by a pantheon of gods were now being delegated instead by the one created God to the whole of humanity. If you like, the Imago Dei was being democratized. It was now humankind who were to be the significant players of earthly life. And so the mandate to rule came along with those kingly responsibilities. And There are four particular strands in this idea of humankind made in the image of God that I'd like to now just bring into a conversation with genetics to spark off some discussion. The first is the value and status of each human individual, irrespective of their genetic status. There was a time, of course, when the idea of the image of God was perceived more like a sort of list of characteristics that humans had, rationality, creativity, a kind of list and so on, which distinguished us from the rest of the animal world. But I don't think that really gets us to the heart of the idea as we see it in Genesis. Instead, we see more the idea of a delegated value and status bestowed on humankind by God that exists irrespective of the frailty and transience of human life. So the value and status of humankind is established not by some set of intrinsic capabilities, but by divine decree. Whereas in the Babylonian creation myths, humans are created in order to be the slaves of the god, here in Genesis, it is God who cares for humankind and who provides for them. And so those whose genetic endowment entails they suffer some sort of handicap, perhaps an early death, or might be physical or mental handicap of some kind, they're as much sharers of the image of God as anyone else. And so the fact of humankind being made in God's image subverts any move to make distinctions between people based on their genome endowment. By the same token, that fact also provides a powerful motivation to engage in the healing of those with genetic disease, as we see, of course, in the healing ministry of Jesus. Not, of course, the genes are mentioned, but taking the total panoply of his mission on earth as being part of that as a mission of healing. And so for Christians, it's Christ who perfectly practices what being made in the image of God is all about. Now, the second strand I'd like to draw out in this conversation between genetics and the Imago Dei is that sheer physicality of the Genesis teaching about the image of God. So here we have humankind as the embodied self, if you like, which is a theme which is kind of picked up and amplified throughout the rest of the Old Testament scriptures. So humankind are not spirits, they're not angels, they're people made from dust. Genesis 2:7, the Lord God formed Yatsar, Adam, from the Adama, from dust of the ground, breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and the Adam became a nefesh, the Adam became a living being. And so the Adam became an animated, enervated body. As the theologian Gerhard von Rad, who once commented, and I quote from him, "One does well to separate as little as possible the bodily and spiritual. The whole man is created in the image of God," close quote. And so as we work through the Old Testament, we find this very unitary idea of personhood. Yes, with different aspects, but where words for soul and spirit are kind of mixed up and switched around and used sometimes interchangeably and so on and so forth. Basically, the human personhood in Hebrew literature is that very much a central, unified identity. But with different aspects. So I want to suggest that resonates quite well, actually, with Dicey, in which the various components of biological development are completely integrated in an ongoing interactionist process. So we don't, it's not that we have bodies, we don't have bodies, we are our bodies. We are our genomes just as much as we are our epigenetics. We are our brains with their 10 to the 14 synaptic connections. So we are that myriad set of interacting components that integrate together during development. We are all of that. We are that stuff. Okay. So far from being this fragmented, tripartite sort of being in Hebrew thought, there is a kind of reveling in the sheer wonder of the physical integration of personhood, if I can call it that. The third resonance we note between the idea of the image of God in our genetic identity is its insistence that involves diversity, male and female. He created them. That's repeated twice in this context of the early teaching of the image of God. It's what the theologian Karl Barth claimed as the definitive explanation given by the text itself of the image of God. So in Barth's view, God's image in man is the reciprocal relationship of human being with human being. The image describes the I-thou relationship between person and person and between a person and God. Well, I think generally amongst theologians there is a consensus that probably Bahá'í went a bit too far in that particular direction. He rather overstated the case. But nevertheless, I think there is an important kernel of truth here. In other words, the image is not a sort of static status quo. It's not a list of qualities as we were just thinking, human characteristics, but it's an ongoing developmental process carried out in relationship. Maybe less like a mirror, more like a prism in which God delegates responsibilities through the human social community in which male and female are equally collaborating. And so this theological account, I think, again, coheres well with the biological story that Dicey provides, a story that focuses on the development of diversity, that guarantees the uniqueness of every human being who's ever lived, as I say, on the planet, whoever will live. So it's not that cloned human beings couldn't be loved by God, it's not that cloned human beings couldn't have relationships, and so on and so forth. It's just that if there were masses of cloned human beings on this planet, then appreciating and entering into that diversity of relationship, I think, would be a whole lot more difficult. Okay, it would be extremely difficult, actually. So, in reality, the genetic diversity that exists between individuals, as I say, is far greater than we'd imagined a few years ago. And far from seeing that as a threat, I would want to see that as a wonderful thing, actually, something to celebrate, providing we keep this matrix whereby human value and dignity, as it were, is guaranteed within that understanding of the Imago Dei as this declaration by God that we are actually in His image, His declaration of imagehood, as it were, for the whole of humanity. And then that will free us up to kind of celebrate this diversity and this immense variation, its various expressions in personhood, once we, I think, are founded, as it were, in that framework of the image of God. The fourth point, last we noticed in the idea of this image of God, is his entailment of moral responsibilities and duties placed upon humankind. So clearly, in Genesis, we have the understanding of genuine choice, which might actually seem quite obvious to us now. But if you think of it in its context, the very suggestion proposed a very profound threat to that reigning Mesopotamian ideology in that original context. Because in these ancient mimetic societies, indeed, as in some societies today, the socio-political order was seen as a kind of microcosm of the larger world of the gods. And so any deviation from that original divine pattern was seen as regression or even rebellion, revolution, and so it was to be resisted. And that's a particular relevance, of course, to the mass of people at that time who have fixed social roles in these very stratified Babylonian Sumerian societies. So free choice didn't come into it. That wasn't part of the story. But here in Genesis, we have this delegated responsibility, the possibility of disobeying, which of course happened. And that's an incredibly powerful message if you think about the context of the time. And so the command given in Genesis 2, then, not to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, was a powerful rhetoric, if you like, or challenge to ongoing understandings of fatalism at the time. So there are terrible consequences, as we all know, separation of the tree of life. I mean, the assumption of genuine human responsibility here is quite inescapable. And then lastly, as we've just been thinking about, I mean, there is no real suggestion of understanding in the genetics that we've been looking at, the biology we've been looking at, that of any kind of serious hard form of genetic determinism, apart from the sort of genetic pathologies I was just mentioning. So it's not that genes influence. Genes don't actually influence us. They certainly don't control us as if our genomes were somehow operating in a separate space from us. We are, as I said, our genomes. They are part of our identity, they are part of our rich development of our individual personhoods. So there are no genes, of course, for gluttony, nor for impetuosity, nor for crime, nor for living in Oxford, nor for voting Labour, nor for voting Conservative, nor even for pursuing a PhD in mathematical biology, whatever it might be. There are no genes for that. Of course, there are people who choose to do all of those things, hopefully not all at the same time. And I think that, to me, is the wonderful story of genetics, of the great freedom we have to choose in the way that God wants us to choose. So with that thought, I'll close. Thank you very much for your attention.
Well, thank you very much, Dennis, for that wonderful talk. Have we any questions?
And this is a shameless plug for the bookstore, by the way. So just to show how much the prices are reduced. Right, over to you for questions.
As a probability theorist, I'm afraid I'm a little worried by some of the numbers you used to set up your argument against soft determinism. Because I would contend that, for example, your Y chromosome argument, if you actually calculate the correlation, it will be quite small, because it's not a very good predictor, there's lots of false positives. And so I'm just a little worried about the story you're telling, that it is a bit of a straw man at that point. And I wonder whether the soft determinism story is actually more valid at a social broad scale. It's told often at the individual scale, but is there any problem with using it and saying, if one has these types of genes, then we notice one is more likely to be obese. And that's a perfectly reasonable story to tell. I'm just a little worried that by saying we always have to work in this integrated, complementary, complex way, we actually might not be able to say very much.
I think that's correct. Yeah, so the two or three points in there. I think this is, I mean, certainly the behavioral geneticists don't like the development biologists very much. For those precisely, because they say, well, how do you, you know, how do you go about the business then of finding out anything? So my purpose actually is not to be particularly dismissive of behavioral genetics, but just to point out its limitations, actually, which many people in the field would agree with, okay? But I think now also with increasing ability to genetically manipulate mice and so on, we do have a handle actually on the development biology in a way that we didn't have, you know, let's say 10 years or 20 years ago. So with conditional knockouts and recombinase and so on and so on, you know, so the tools now to actually, at least in animal studies, to look at even things like autism spectrum disorders, all that sort of thing, a whole lot more powerful. So I would say the developmental biologists do have actually a lot of tools now. Not so much, obviously we can't do that in the human, and that's the problem. Yeah. So in the human we are rather dependent on looking at certain correlations and so on. So I'm sort of agreeing with you. I think I also agree with you on the Y chromosome. I think the time when that's quite nice to mention that though is when you do get these studies looking at some correlation between variant X and some particular population and so on. And the danger, I mean, I guess the danger is just over-interpreting that data. And I think what you're saying is one can over-interpret the Y chromosome data as well, which I think is a fair point. But I think that is not a bad point to mention in the context of over-interpretation of correlations between a certain genetic variants and behavior X, Y, or Z, whatever it might be. In terms of obesity, the genetics of obesity, as I know, is very complex. I mean, it's a very difficult genetics and so on. I suppose the there you've got, again, complete integration of genetic variants and people's hunger, appetites, and experience, and lifestyle, and advertising. It's all kind of together, isn't it? One great big mush. And you could say the same also, I suppose, about criminality, let's say, or impetuosity. But I think I would see some slight differences there in the sense that, so we're going to get deep water here. I'll perhaps stop there. Okay, I think there are some distinct differences one could probably draw up a list actually between something like looking at the genetics of obesity and its relationship to its own social context and the way society operates, and between criminality, let's say something like criminality, I think, but that would be a whole kind of long discussion. Obviously, obesity has only become huge epidemic, hasn't it, in the Western world in the past 20, 30 years. So clearly, there are very strong environmental and choice implications there, I think. So, yeah, that's not the same with criminality. So there's lots of differences one can make there.
You talked about the difference between academic literature and popular literature.
Yes.
And obviously there's a dilution process going on there. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering whether you have any suggestions about, you know, how we can respond to that divide. Mm-hmm. Or say, if I were a journalist, what would you say to me before I were to publish, you know, say a report on this lecture?
Yeah, I would say, let's say we're reporting on behavioral genetics, let's say some new discovery, let's say this finished thing. I think then I would just suggest various ways of presenting the results that actually are reasonably fair to the data. You know, I mean, you can't tell journalists to make the whole story boring. Their job is to sell papers. I mean, you know, so it's hard. It's hard being a journalist. It's not easy at all. I have a great sympathy actually for journalists in that respect. But I think you can mention things like, well, let's avoid this language of gene for a human behavior and explain there are no genes for human behaviors. There might be genetic variants that influence or have some, you know, relevance to human behaviors, but there are no genes for human behaviors. I think that's a good start, you know, so you can make up a certain list of things. Could you try and avoid that sort of language? Could you avoid a language where it looks like genes are sort of, as it were, imposing their will upon the human individual, okay, as if we're somehow, you've got genes up here pulling the strings of life, you know, and we're just puppets being pulled by genes. If they could avoid that sort of language, that language often is there in popular reports and so on. So I think there is, you know, and I mean, I've been involved a bit quite a bit actually, with public understanding of science, courses for journalists, that sort of thing. And those are the sorts of points I think are worth getting across. Always check your story with the author if you can, let them read it through, you know. Lots of journalists won't want to do that. But, you know, in the serious broadsheets, they might be willing, they will be willing. I get sent stuff, you know, please can you check this text, and so on. And that's very helpful. But you don't want to make it, you know, you can't make it like a scientific paper, obviously. As I say, they've got to sell their story. So it's a difficult balance, I think.
Perhaps we'll just have one more question so that there's got time to get away then.
I'm all right, I can leave at 9. If people can buy their books in about 3 minutes.
Perhaps one more, thank you.
I just want to make sure I understand one distinction. Yeah. When you're talking about correlation and causation.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to things like disease, does the same rule apply, or is there a relationship between correlation and causation? Because, I'll give you an example. I have a very good friend whose daughter is about to have a prophylactic double mastectomy because she's been told that she has a genetic disposition toward breast cancer. Now, it seems to me that is clearly someone who's making a determination mathematically that there's a relationship between this correlation and causation. I assume that's good science, or else they wouldn't have this young girl going through this dramatic operation. I want to understand if there is a distinction between behavioral genetics and that kind of pathology, or if in both instances there isn't, or there is, a clear-cut relationship.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. That's a very good question. Okay, so on the medical genetic side, often, in the case you're talking about, is the BRCA1 gene or the BRCA2 gene,
BRCA2
and those are the genes involved, and I don't think anyone, I certainly wouldn't have any problem in saying they are causal for breast and ovarian cancer, in the sense that if you have those particular mutations, then your chances of having either go up to around 80%. Okay, so are they causal agents in that? Yeah, I think so. I think, so causation, so here's an interesting thing about the language of causation. No, but if you come to me and say, well, here we found a genetic variant which seems to correlate with, let's say, IQ, intelligence, let's say, you know. And is that causal for someone who, you know, is very, very intelligent? I would say no. Okay, no. So is that, you know, playing with language? Well, it's just that, you know, when you have a complex, any kind of complex system, the thing about your car, you know, so if you have a car and you have one, if you have your spark plug, it's dirty, and the engine won't start, okay. Is the spark plug causal in terms of the malfunction of that engine? Yeah, I think so. Yeah, it's a causal agent in that sense. But if you then ask the question, well, is the spark plug causal in having a really amazing engine that goes 10 miles faster than the next car? I would say no. That's a function of the system as a whole. It's just the slippery way in which the language of causation works. So in other words, what I'm saying here is that maybe there are thousands of genetic variants which are involved in intelligence. Let's just accept that for the moment. So you could say, well, that system as a whole is sort of causal for having a higher intelligence. But by that time, we sort of lost the language of causality. So it's a rather roundabout way of saying that if you have a system that's malfunctioning, then the language of causality becomes much more easy to use, okay? Because you can identify the malfunction. You can say that's the cause of the malfunction, and so that's why the system isn't working as it normally would. So the language of causality becomes much easier. If you're talking about a normally functioning system but just varies around the mean, and let's take intelligence, varies around the mean, okay? Then picking on one, it's a very popular intelligence. What is it? We don't know. You know, you can spend a long time trying to define it and understand it, but whatever it is, it's something complex, it's a function of human behavior in certain contexts with certain educational backgrounds, it's defined differently in China and Japan compared to the West, and so on and so on. So, you know, what they count as intelligence traditionally is not the same as what we count, and so on. So it's a very complex human functioning trait, whatever you want to call it, and therefore the language of causality, just when it comes to genetics, doesn't fit, actually, you know, because it's not malfunctioning. Now, if you then say, well, what about a person, again, come back to medical genetics, what about the poor person who's trisomy 21 or Down syndrome, this person has a lower intelligence, you know. Is the trisomy, is the extra chromosome 21 causal? Yeah, I think so. Here we have a system that's not functioning around the mean. You know, it's not just oscillating around the mean, it's actually, you know, there is a reason there why that individual has a lower intelligence. Okay. So I think it's... the language of causation is much easier to cope with, if you like, or to use in the arena of medical genetics. Much easier than in behavioral genetics, where, you know, it's much more complex. So, but the language of causation, I mean, philosophers write whole books, you know, on the language of causation. It's tricky language, actually, quite tricky. And how you communicate that to journalists, I don't know. It's very hard.
Well, I think we'll... stop the questioning there. So please do join me in thanking Dr. Frank and Russell.